When did you first get the idea you might become a writer?
When I was about 8 or 9 years old, and I was walking beside the river in Alt Bay, and I noticed that it just looked particularly beautiful. Wasn't a word I would have used at that time, but it struck me, and I thought, I've got to remember this because I'm going to have to write about it one day.
And what did you do anything then? Did you actually go and write down about it, or was it the ideas or phrases? Did phrases come into your mind?
No, it was a visual thing, and that picture had to remain with me because I had to use it at some point in the future. That's the way I felt at the time.
And did you?
I've written several pieces that use that landscape and indeed the feelings of that moment. It's a part of my life that comes back again and again and brings life into short stories or whatever. I don't mean that it's used mechanically, simply that's a kind of state of feeling that I return to when I'm writing.
So effectively it's almost like a sort of condensed image or something where, you know, you've got a certain core feeling that really interests you, something to do with your essential sense of life and what it's about. Is there something caught, or who you are in relation to the world is caught in that moment, is that right?
It's a very solid internal place that I can return to and rely on. It's like having a touchstone.
When you did start to write, what were you drawn to? Was it prose or was it poetry?
Poetry. Poetry and, in fact, songs. When I was about 9 or 10, I remember writing short poems, songs, most of which are, thank goodness, lost now. I remember one or two lines which embarrassed me enormously, so I'm glad the rest of it's gone.
Well, I'll ask you then what these might be.
No,
then
I will reveal them to no one.
Okay, so yes, what was the exact place that you were in fact growing up there?
Alt Bay, on the west coast of Ross-shire.
And can you describe that? I've not been to that particular place.
Oh, it's west coast scenery. It's loads of open space. I used to wander for hours, even days sometimes, on the moors by myself or with my brothers and sisters, rarely with other children from the village. I think most people regarded this as a bit strange. Several times people in the village were out looking for me because they thought I was lost, but in fact I wasn't lost at all. I was just wandering. So there's lots of open space, and there's that wonderful lacy edge between the sea and the land over the sort of like mini fjords all the way along the coast there, and islands. There's lochs up on the moors, dragonflies, bogs that go down forever. It's a wonderful place. I loved it.
We're perceived slightly separate. Why is that? Why would that have been?
We came from outside. We actually came from Clydebank. And we moved there when I was about 5 years old.
Oh, as kids.
I had one older brother and eventually 4 younger siblings.
Oh, right.
So there was a whole bunch of us there.
Your parents, though, I mean did they, you know, you can say I want to get out of the city, but why to that place?
I think my dad was in the Navy during the war, and they were stationed in Alt Bay. Loch Hugh has got a narrow enough mouth that they could put a boom across it to protect it from submarines. So there was a lot of naval boats in there during the war. And my dad was working as a baker in Clydebank and saw an advert for a bakery for sale.
Oh, really?
Or for lease, rather, in Alt Bay, and remembered it and went for it. Looking back now, it was a tremendously brave thing to do, give up a steady job as a baker in Clydebank and go up into the middle of what was effectively nowhere. At that time, it was not easy to get to the west coast from Inverness. It was probably about 2.5-3 hours to get across there along single track roads. It really was pretty remote. In retrospect, it was a very brave thing for my parents to do.
And it also meant that they were, as a baker, he was going to have to interface with everyone immediately in the community and actually hold a kind of key role, in a sense, at the heart. The bread is quite a thing. Yeah, and, you know, were your parents people who read to you, or did they, do you remember any particular ways where you feel that they sort of encouraged your imagination to leap around.
Absolutely. My dad used to read us Moby Dick and Tales from Odysseus and things like that as bedtime stories. We didn't have that many books in the house because I think actually money was tight. But we read our way through the local library when it was available, and they both liked books. Although there weren't a lot of books in the house, we were always encouraged to read.
Where did you go to school?
When it came to the time of 11 plus, I was sent through to Dingwall. We had to stay in the hostel in Dingwall and attend Dingwall Academy. And my older brother was there as well. About that time, various different things happened. First off, the roads improved, which meant that Burnett's could now send trucks through to the West Coast with Burnett's bread, which they baked in a large factory, and could consequently sell a lot cheaper than my father could, because he was baking in a small old-fashioned bakery in Alt Bay. And eventually, he and my mum decided it was time to give up the bakery. We moved over to the East Coast, and my dad went away to college for 4 years to become an art teacher. Again, an immensely brave thing to do, but as you do when you're young, you just accept that's what people do. And it was only much later on I realised, well, that's not what people do unless they really have got a lot of gumption and a fair amount of courage as well.
Yeah, it's huge courage, really. What about your mum? What was her meaning? With all these children she might have been...
Well, she found that even with six children, she had time on her hands, so she started a pottery business. And in fact, while my dad was away at college, she managed to support us all, apart from my father's grant, of course, which was a student grant, which didn't go very far in a family of six children. So my mum was decorating and painting pottery and selling it.
Where did she make her pots? Did she have a studio within the house, or was it somewhere else?
Well, at first we lived in the old army encampment at the top of the Souter, above Cromarty, and we used the old gun emplacements as pottery and kiln and so on. And then we managed to get a house.
Amazing. That's an amazing
That's a wonderful image. Place. The hill falls away like that, you know, one of those curves that just gets steeper and steeper and steeper, and you're looking out over the North Sea and there's nothing out that way but Norway. It's absolutely glorious. You come up and it's like taking a deep breath, just a sudden space up there. Again, this sudden space. And these old gun emplacements and blockhouses and so on, we used to run wild in, and some of them, as I say, were using us, well, one for storage, one for the pottery, one for the kiln room. And
that's quite nice. That's like that old thing of having, you know, cleats, like on St Kilda. I know it sounds an odd one, but it's almost like a sort of latter day thing there, where they had these bits of stone, didn't they? They made little stone cupboards up in the hill,
that's
really.
Right, yeah.
I suppose at the shoelings that would have been a thing as well. Yeah, it's a quite Highland thing, really, despite it being gun emplacement.
Well, once we moved down to Cromarty, the house that my parents managed to get had a tumble-down cottage right next to it, which was part of the property, and that has been, for many years, a pottery. In fact, goodness Lord, it's been a pottery for 35 years now. Pottery and pottery shop and various different incarnations at different parts of... Sometimes the shop was in the house, sometimes it was in the cottage. They're no longer running it now, but my sister-in-law runs it. She's a potter, so she's taken over.
So, did you go to university?
To Aberdeen. And I eventually got a degree, but it was in fact a bad move in many ways. There was a stupid misunderstanding, which is, I thought when you were studying English at university, you were learning how to write.
That's
got nothing to do with it. It was a mistake in many ways. I mean, I enjoyed my time at university. I made lots of friends. But in academic terms, no, it was a waste of time. The only time that degree has ever been of any use for me was when I got a temporary job as a mathematics teacher in a Buddhist monastery in India. You've got a degree. Would you like to teach mathematics? It meant I got free accommodation and food for a few weeks.
So, right, so let's see. So when you come out of university and you're going to sort of, you know, follow some thread of your life that's obviously not now being dictated by your education, not necessarily either by your locality, because in a way that's...
Yes, I was at university effectively twice. I failed all my exams because I was doing other things. wasting my time, most people would call it, but that's not what I would call it. Failed my exams, went away and did lots of travelling, working in various different places, Jordan, Amman, Turkey, travelling mainly in the East, in the Middle East, and then eventually I just realised one day that I felt bad about the fact that I'd got halfway through a degree and never finished it, and that's unfinished business. So I went back and took another year and finished it off.
Mm-hmm.
So that was out of the way. And as I say, the degree has been of very little use to me, but I would have felt a sense of incompleteness forever if I hadn't gone back and dealt with it. Mm-hmm. And that was, in fact, at that second visit to university was when I really started writing. And I was in a writer's group with various other people even Stephen, for instance, was a member of that writer's mm-hmm. group. That's when I...
That's Ian Stephen, who's the poet who's on Lewis, is
that
right?
That's right, yes. Yeah. Poet, short story writer, sculptor, photographer. One of these people. And even just from meeting... In fact, from meeting Ian, that was worthwhile, because he's been immensely supportive to me over the years, and I've just really enjoyed having a friend who can talk about writing with me.
Mm.
Because most writers know that writing can be a very isolated experience. You know.
When you then began writing, I think that's very interesting that you took this time, as you say, travelling in these Middle Eastern countries, very different culture, very different ground rules. You would have had to make all sorts of adjustments and see things that would have surprised you. Did that happen, or did you feel very at ease?
Well, no, I was terrified. I mean, I really, really wanted to travel. I really wanted to see India in particular. But I was not particularly confident. But again, I was in that situation where I knew if I didn't try it, I would never be happy with myself. You know, it was the thing I had to do next. And although I was indeed quite frightened of it. It was at that time it was travelling overland, you know, through Turkey and Iran and Afghanistan to get to India, and it was a big deal. And
mm-hmm.
yeah,
when what
nervous.
Sort of period is that? Actually, I don't know what dates we're talking about.
We're talking about sort of early 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when most of my travelling was done.
Yes.
By the end of that decade, I'd pretty much done the travelling that I needed to do at that point, and I had a child on the way, and that was time to do more solid, grounded things like make a living.
So how did you go about doing that, making a living?
It's a long time ago now, but I worked in a couple of cooperatives, Jaws Whole Food Cafe in Aberdeen.
Oh, yeah.
And Bramble's Whole Foods shop in what I enjoyed about that was the fact that you're in charge of your own mm. living, and in fact it must be 20 years or so since I've actually worked for anybody else. I've been self-employed since then, which is the way I like to work. So after doing that for a while, I did various other jobs, none of which had any particular future in them. I was a gardener at Castle Loud for a year or so. I was a sawyer at the sawmill at near Strathpeffer for about a year and a half.
Mm.
And then I became, I started working as a joiner, which was an accidental sort of thing, because we needed to convert a house because there was a baby on the way and it needed a house to live in. So we bought a wreck of a house and turned it into a very good house and lived in there for 5-6 years. And by the time I'd finished doing that, I was reasonably competent as a joiner, and pretty much that's the way I've made a living ever since, various aspects of joining to make a living. I'm somebody who actually is writing because it's the art form that they most enjoy.
Yes.
That they're most suited to. And several times I've tried to actually to look into the possibilities of making a living
doing something
at writing,
commercial.
And it just does not somehow appeal to me.
It deadens your soul, does it?
Well, if you want to put it like that, I wouldn't put it quite like that, but It's yes, when I look down that kind of pathway, it looks like a diminishing tunnel. You know, it looks like I'm going to get to a dead end.
Yes.
And that's not what I'm doing. And right now, I'm perfectly happy with the fact that there's a way that I make a living, and that allows me time to do my writing.
So, what was your very first experience? What were your first experiences of publication then?
Apart from a couple of poems and writing magazines that I redeemed when I was at university, probably the first thing I had published was a story in West Coast Magazine.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was issue 3, and it was called The Hunting of God, and that short story is in fact been incorporated in Writing in the Sand, which is a very peculiar thing, because it must be about 15 years ago that was published.
And Writing in the Sand is the name of your new book?
That's it, yes.
Yeah. Now, have you written any other novels, in fact?
No, this was the sort of the third time that I attempted something large, and the other two times it kind of petered out. But when I was doing Writing in the Sand, I didn't know it was going to turn into a novel. It was only when I realised that I'd written about 50,000 to 70,000 words that I realised it was something big that I was working on.
What did you say, how long is this book?
It's about 180,000 words.
Yeah. And when you started writing it, so you're not a person who said, I've always got a plan then. You just so what's the sort of state of mind that you want to be in starting to write? Is there anything that you do or want to be when you do it? Or do you just sit down and there it goes?
I'm not quite sure what you mean here. I mean, I sit down...
Sense of direction. I mean, do you just sit down and doodle? Or what? You know, how do you take up a direction at all? Or do you?
You write until you find out where you're going.
Right, it's probably the
best way of putting it. Sometimes, as I say, it peters out, and it just seems to me the more often you do it, the more regularly you do it, the more likely you are to find it going somewhere.
Yeah.
Because I think the main direction of my writing does not come from what I'm consciously intending. I don't sit down with a theme or an idea that I'm writing to. I sit down and I start writing, and I watch where it's going, because something inside me, something subconscious, is actually in charge, and is in much better charge, of the direction that I'm going than I can consciously manage. It's discovery, as much as anything.
And this Writing in the Sand, so where did that, as you started to write that, what were your first inklings of where you were going?
I better tell you the story of how it came to be. The village of Cromarty, which is where I lived when I was a teenager and where several of my family still live, is a fascinating village, full of eccentrics and full of people who enjoy and tolerate eccentrics, which is quite an unusual thing. And again, I lived among some very odd people who were part of the village and were valued as part of the village. And Cromarty has got its own community website, and I was asked if I knew someone who could write a story, an ongoing story, episode by episode, that would coax people into coming back to the website week after week. And I said, well, of course I can do it if you want. And I sat down and I wrote the first episode, which was about 2,500 words. And I'd been asked to do about 700-800 words, you know, per week.
Mm-hmm.
So first episode turned out to be 2,500 words, which was fine, because it was the introductory one. I had to introduce the characters and so on. And at this stage, it was tremendous fun, because I was creating lots of characters that I could pull in later to do all sorts of things with. Creating puppets that I could make them dance later on. And then the second week, it was 3,000 words. And then the next week, another 2,000 words. The characters were growing, the background was growing, and I was really enjoying it. It was just so much... It was creation. It was creation. I didn't know where any of it was going, but all the characters and the situations that I was inventing I could see that they would join together in interesting ways sometime further down the line. I was setting things up so that I would have lots of stuff to write about. And I just kept on doing this. And about 9 months later, I looked at what I'd written and suddenly realised that I knew exactly where it was going and that it was already well over 50,000 words and it was a novel. Yeah? And it just kind of sneaked up on me. It didn't start off life as a novel, it started off as this episodic story. Turned into a novel, yes. Unfortunately, after about, about 100,000 words or so, unfortunately in a way, but fortunately in another way, I got the job as writer in residence for Aberdeenshire, and thoroughly enjoyed that.
How did you deal with achieving your end point?
It was when I'd reached about 70,000 words or so, it just suddenly became obvious to me that I knew where all the different threads of the story were going.
Oh, so you did actually, at that point, preconceive the pattern, and so you just had to fill it
in. Yes, I didn't know how it was all going to reach that end, and that was the fun
of it. I knew
where it was going.
Ah, right.
Didn't yet know how it was going to get there.
Yes.
And that was part of the enjoyment of it.
Yes.
Tweaking it and adjusting the storylines and getting the characters to interact in such a way that it just kept heading towards that end point, but without it being obvious. It is a story that's got probably about, I think, five main sets of characters. Each one has their own separate story, but they're all heading in the same direction, and they all come to the same point right at the very end. When they all coincide, they all collide, however you want to put it. There seem to be rules to the structure of a story, and the use of coincidence seems to break those rules. What's happening in this book, in Writing in the Sand, is more to do with the fact that although we all live in a world in which all the physical details are the same, we interpret them differently. It's almost like we're living in parallel worlds. My vision of reality overlaps with yours to a certain extent. But it often seems that people are living in a different version of reality from each other. Although the physical details are the same, their interpretations of it are so different that they actually seem to be living in different worlds. And in Writing in the Sand, we've got a set of about five different main characters, each of whom seems to be living in a different world. When you are following the story thread of the Reverend Dumfrey, for instance, his version of reality is real. But when he encounters Doreen and Alice, who are the priestesses of a Celtic god who have to live in this village called Cromness, their version of reality is real for the time that you're reading their thread of the story. And part of the delight that I had in the story was bringing them all to the same point at the end when the denouement occurs. So,
by the same point, are you implying that a point of mutual enhanced understanding, or that's not really what you're meaning? No,
I mean that there are certain physical events at the end of the story that are identical for all of them, and bring the story effectively to a close. Mm. The interpretation of each of them of what happened at that point is quite different. Yeah. But in each case, it's a satisfactory explanation. I mean, it all ties together.